Support for Soundwaves from the Underground is brought to you by 24tix.com, the most convenient way to buy tickets to your favorite local concerts. Save time, save money, rock out. 24tix.com, your ticket to the experience.
Okay, I'm making a note right now for whatever that next Olympics that we're bidding on in 2026. I want to see high air to mogul snowboarding.
I'm down, I'll watch that.
I'm Dan Nalen, and you have dialed up the Soundwaves from the Underground podcast, the official podcast of Slug Magazine in Salt Lake City, Utah. Slug, an acronym for Salt Lake Underground, is one of the oldest independent publications in the United States, publishing monthly on arts, music, subculture, you name it. You can find everything Slug Magazine at slugmag.com. In this episode, we talk to, of all things, a Mormon sexologist. We talk to John Cooley, creative director of L1 Outerwear. And we have Slug's own Mike Brown in the studio to talk Utah jazz, because you will not find a bigger jazz fan than Mike Brown. Two words you would never assume would go together are Mormon and sexologist, but that is exactly what Dr. Melissa Jones is. The San Antonio woman conducts one-on-one sessions and group classes about all manners of sexuality, intimate relationships with people who may not have learned it on their own or through their families or their church or anywhere else. And she travels the country sharing her knowledge and putting on clinics, including one recently in Salt Lake, and she has another one coming up soon. Isha B sat down with Jones to talk about her classes and her lessons and what she has to offer.
So tell us who you are and what you do.
I am a sexologist from San Antonio, but I was born and raised in Utah. So that's what keeps bringing me back to Utah.
Even though it's cold here. Is it cold in San Antonio?
Not this cold.
Yeah, not this cold. It is really cold right now.
It's very cold here today.
So as a Mormon, and I mean, this isn't a secret, of course, you're just talking about it. As a Mormon, how do you align your job as a sexologist with your religion's typically conservative stance on sex?
Well, that's exactly why I went into the whole area of sexology, because I feel like there needs to be a better alignment of the two, of sex and religion, you know, because we have sex. Everyone has sex. All those Mormons are having sex, and we know they are.
That's where those babies are coming
exactly,
from.
Exactly, right? And so, you know, funny enough, I served a lot with the young women in the LDS church, and I realized that a lot of parents aren't doing a good job of talking to their youth about it, and it's not because they don't want to, they just don't know how, and they weren't taught about sex or how to have sex or what sex is. Instead, it's just be virtuous. You know, stay clean till you're married. Well, okay, and then we get married, and what are we supposed to do with that information?
Yeah.
And so I wanted to go into a field where I could help parents educate their children and also become educated themselves. So, you know, I often tell people I'm an adult sex educator, meaning, you know, I educate adults about sex because they need it also. They need that help.
Well, and hopefully you're doing a better job than the sex education that we have in our public schools.
Oh, absolutely.
You're the extended version that we never got.
Yeah, Texas is the same way.
Do you believe that the church will take your view eventually through revelations, or is that something that you could predict?
I hope so. And, you know, I do see subtle changes. Just a few months ago in the Ensign, there was an article actually on the importance of intimacy in the relationship. And, you know, I do see that the LDS church is changing, you know, their stance on homosexuality, and that they're trying to become more accepting and understanding of it. And, you know, I don't think that they're ever going to get up in general conference and say, you know, brothers and sisters, have sex every night.
Sure.
You know, that's just not what they're going to do. But if you look back, there are subtle messages. You know, I think President Hinckley was ahead of his time when he told couples, date every week.
Yeah, and do something fun and keep it fresh.
Exactly.
And fun.
And I think, you know, I can translate that into go on a date every week and then come home and have sex.
Yeah. And that translates to anybody, Mormon or not.
Absolutely.
Because, you know,
absolutely,
if you've been in a long-term relationship, you know that you have to put the effort into it to keep it.
Exactly.
Keep it going. So as a sexologist, you deal with everything sex, from the fun stuff to the disorders and not so fun stuff as well. Do you find yourself addressing a lot of sexual weirdness? I mean, in this day and age, you got everything.
Oh, I do. I get those phone calls. You know, I've had stalkers from Jamaica call me wanting my help, and I say that nicely when I say stalkers, but definitely I do. I see it all. And luckily I had a really, really great training program, you know, at UNLV that helped me so that when I do get those phone calls or people coming through my door, I just say, all right, let's work through this.
Well, I mean, of all people, you would be the one to understand where it's coming from.
Oh, yeah.
Or at least to want to try to understand where it's coming
exactly.
from.
Exactly. And, you know, I try not to have a shocked look on my face because every once in a while, there is something new that I learn about and I think, oh, okay.
Yeah.
You know, inside I'm thinking, what in the world? But outwardly, I just think, all right, well, let's learn about this together.
Well, I think that's awesome, too, because hearing that from a doctor is obviously not as common either to hear from a doctor who will say that you still have stuff to learn and that you want to continuously learn. So thank you for that, too. There's a lot of weirdness that we talk about in America. Pornography especially comes up. Is that some? How do you feel about porn? Can it be helpful or is it harmful to healthy and normal sexuality?
I think it depends on who you're talking about, what age group you're talking about. Everyone's different. Everyone is completely different. Now, do I want my 12-year-old son watching pornography? Absolutely not. There's no way he can't process that. If a couple came to me and they said, you know, we want to learn how to be better at giving each other oral sex, I'm going to gauge that relationship and I may say, okay, are you guys ready for an educational DVD that you're going to watch together in the bedroom and it's just going to be the two of you? Great. Go for it.
Very interesting. So then for educational purposes, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, again, it's individual across the board.
And that's always the case when it comes to psychological or psychiatric situations.
And there may be couples that there's no way I would ever recommend that to. They just couldn't. They may never, ever be ready for that.
On a lighter note, you do get to deal with some of the fun stuff too. And you have a series of fun workshops coming up in Salt Lake City?
I do, yes. At the end of January, actually the first weekend of February, I get to teach some workshops at the Blue Boutique.
Very cool. And how'd that relationship come to be?
It's kind of a funny story. The very, very first sex toy store I ever went into, or adult novelty store, whatever you want to call it, was the Blue Boutique back when I was very, very first married. And I remember just thinking, oh my gosh, I'm walking in here. I can't believe I'm doing this, you know? Is anyone going to see me? And it was my husband and I together. And I walked in and I just thought, oh, this is lingerie. This isn't that big of a deal. And then I saw the doors to the back.
The secret room.
The secret door, yeah. And I thought, what's going to happen to me if I walk in here? You know, what, is it the end of the world? And my husband and I walked in and looked around and, you know, we picked our first adult novelty toy.
I love
them. It was great. And that was the beginning of a good relationship with lots of adult toys and I'll embarrass us, whatever. Now we have cases and cases under our bed of adult toys.
You know what? I love your realness. Your sense of honesty is so refreshing.
Yeah, I don't know if my kids feel that way all the time. But a lot of them I take with me, you know, to workshops and stuff. But yeah, if I can't, I have to try it to be able to recommend it
Absolutely.
To someone, you know if it's good or not. But as I've been doing workshops and traveling and stuff, I thought, you know, my family's in Utah. I'm going to contact the Blue Boutique, just see if they have any interest in me coming out and just kind of develop a relationship, you know, see what they think. And they said, absolutely, we would love to have you come.
So cool.
And work here. And they have been fantastic to me.
Well, and they're awesome, too. I mean, they're one of our Slug family favorites.
Yeah,
so.
We love them. They have just, my husband and I have been treated very, very well by them. And, you know, they just, every time I come out, they're just so great. They've become kind of an extended family. And it's really nice that it's come full circle for me. So from that being my first experience with a toy.
Love
it. And now I get to go be there and teach workshops.
And help other people with that experience. Because it's very interesting for me. I'm a lucky person who I don't have what I think of as a lot of sexual hang-ups, so I don't think of things like that. I was not fazed when I went into Blue Boutique for the first time, and I think it's very eye-opening to hear that from somebody else, maybe raised in a different circumstance, that could be a very stressful thing, and then to have somebody like you who's willing to say, hey, listen, it doesn't have to be stressful, and I understand because I've been there, and I've gotten over it and gotten past it, so I think that is cool. And then on a side note, too, as far as what your kids think is great or not, all of the things I used to hate about my mom are all the things I love about her now. So I think it's wonderful that you're that person for them that can be open and honest and have those conversations that are so difficult.
I hope so. The only thing, you know, my 12-year-old son just has to remind me. Well, actually, a couple weeks ago, he said, "Mom, please just don't have me bring in your work stuff from the car anymore." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Because it was so embarrassing. You asked me to bring in a bunch of stuff with my friends, and you had all your workshop supplies." And I had to stop and think, and I realized, oh yeah, I had my big tote of dildos from teaching one of my classes, and I thought, yeah, that would be too much for a 12-year-old boy.
I love it. But that's cool that he could tell you that, too. So what other forms of service do you offer? For example, private sessions for couples or individuals, or maybe private workshops for small groups?
I do. I do workshops for small groups, and I really enjoy those. Those are a lot of fun. Bridal showers, if there's a group of women or a group of girlfriends, like, that they are engaged, want kind of like a one-on-one, well, not necessarily one-on-one, but like a group session, wedding night, prep, whatever it might be. I also do Skype sessions or face-to-face sessions. Actually, right now, I have more clients from Utah, even though I'm in San Antonio, that I'm doing FaceTime or Skype sessions
with. Well, probably has a lot to do with that. You're being able to identify with them, so that's cool.
Yeah, and those are, it's great. I love those clients. It's a lot of fun because it's usually only a few sessions that we even need to be together, and then they have this communication breakthrough and they get along really well all of a sudden. You
That's awesome.
It's just learning how to talk with each other.
So what else do you have coming up?
Well, of course, the workshops. And then right now I'm working on a book, which will be fun.
Ooh,
which
exciting.
Takes, I know, I need to be working on it faster, but, you know, life gets in the way. But hopefully my plan is to take all of my homework assignments that I give couples and make it into kind of a workbook format.
Very cool.
Because I get requests all the time for my homework assignments. And they're, you know, the thing is, they're just really simple. They're nice, fun communication exercises, but it goes back to communication, and that is such an unsexy, unfun word.
Yeah.
So if you can roll it into some fun sexiness, then people communicate without realizing that they are.
Dr. Jones, the Mormon sexologist, will be back in Salt Lake City from January 31st to February 2nd to teach some classes at the Blue Boutique with topics ranging from orgasms to oral sex, and there will be Q&As for couples. Fun! For more information on the events, check out blueboutique.com, and for more information on Dr. Jones herself, visit her online at mjsexologist.com. Provo hip-hop artist Chance Lewis usually performs with his fellow hip-hop guy, Apt, and they've become a staple of the 100-block music scene down in Provo, and he is often featured at Muse Music Cafe. In December 2011, Lewis released his debut EP, Underdog, which helped fund his brand new full-length called We're Just Happy to Be Here. That just was released in December 2012, and we're going to play a track off the new one. This is a song called I Need MySpace.
Handed out those flyers, copied them black and white, till I got that grand exposure. Since then I seen the light, since then I caught fire, kinda blew up overnight, but never got closure, got caught up in that fight. Between a bitter veteran and spoiled younger gentleman, who can't remember when a band like this would have to test their mettle in a big city, just to have an itty bitty shot of making it. These days, if you're in last place, you can't blame the race, cause your shoes weren't laced and you fell flat on your face. If McLuhan were alive today, I'll bet he'd say that this medium is up in flames. We're done with weapons, put a bullet in my bulletin. Got some fancy ammo in my bio, yeah, I'm full of it. I'm what would happen if Ann Landers and Sam I Am had a kid. Would it be the first or last I am to come from Nazareth? Give me a moment of your time, I'll cherish it. I'm on cloud now with the cherub sit, sitting online in my Cherokee. The contact info of my nemesis. I was playing Sega Fest and he was rocking Sega Genesis. And now you're telling me that he's the one who's supposed to represent the rest of us? I need my space. Song, it's dissing on technology, blowing up my Twitter feed and constantly barraging me. In the garage when we were hashing out the section of the instrumental, musical direction was a sentimental process, from experimental nonsense. got that grand exposure, since then I seen the light. Since then I caught fire, kinda blew up overnight, but never got closure, got caught up in that fight. I got that grand exposure, and now I'm seeing the light.
To get more info on Chance Lewis and to download his new album for a mere $6, visit him online at wearechancelewis.com. Many of you might know John Cooley as a professional snowboarder who moved to Utah from Alaska to make his name. More recently, he has become the creative director for L1 Outerwear, and Slug contributor Chris Bruntsetter, also a well-known Utah personality in the ski and snowboard scene, is the marketing director for Gold Coast Skateboards, and he sat down with John Cooley to talk about his new position.
Your new gig is the creative director for L1. How did that come about?
Basically, what happened is I've ridden for L1 as a pro snowboarder for roughly 6 years now. I've had a lot of input as far as like the designs go and, you know, what I wanted personally for my pro model stuff. And I think it's added to the direction of the brand. I've always like submitted ideas for things that I wanted or I thought would be cool for the season. Last year, we lost the art director who was doing, he was designing the L1 outerwear, and he was also doing board graphics, and he was doing everything. And we had like a sales meeting, and I had brought my designs that I always, well, not full designs, but ideas in. I didn't know who to give them to with him not around, so I just brought them into the meeting, and right after that meeting, they asked me if I wanted to start designing outerwear. And last year I did 10 pieces of that line, and now like it's a full-time gig.
That's awesome. So do you see it being, I mean, you were kind of at the forefront of the whole, should we call it, fitted, tailored look in snowboarding, and I feel like you helped influence kids just through your own personal style that way. How does it feel now that you have direct control over what kids are wearing? You know, your ideas are now being seen on the slope, like brought into the real world, not just kids imitating you.
I don't know, it's kind of weird, I guess. Like, before it was just like, you'd see it, I'd see kids on the mountain and be like, oh, that's rad, like, a kid's wearing something similar to what I wear, and that's pretty cool to see. But now it's like, I have to watch for those kids. I have to pay attention to those kids who are going to influence the other kids. And I have to kind of like, I mean, I'm going to still add my own personal style and take on it, but I have to pay attention to what's popular and what other kids are doing, influential kids, so.
Kind of what the type of kid you were growing up snowboarding, yeah. You kind of have to look for those kids.
Yeah, I have to pay attention, you know? I have to just watch and see what's going on, because I get stuck in my ways.
Where do you pull your inspiration from? Like, do you have mood boards? Do you, like, where do you look to get inspiration?
Definitely a lot of mood boards. I look all over the place. Like, you know, skateboarding's a huge influence. It always has been. That's pretty much like what I always look towards when I was snowboarding. So it still is a huge influence. Like, I always pay attention to what's going on in skating. And then tons of blogs and people on the street that are cool. Homeless people usually have pretty rad style. You know, Japan is crazy. That place is awesome. You just have to do a toned down version of what they're into because they're pretty advanced.
Yeah, like a 3 out of 10 on the Japan scale.
Yeah. And then you're like, still like kind of ahead of your time. Yeah, I mean, like motorcycles, I pretty much just get inspiration from my life, and then I get a lot of input from the team, and then like the people who work for L1 and Nitro.
So you guys will sit down with the team and you'll let them kind of give their feedback and maybe pitch ideas to you on pieces?
Yeah, well, I mean, usually it's always been like that. This year the design schedule kind of got ramped up a little bit, so I didn't actually have a chance to sit down with the team, but fortunately, a lot of the dudes live here in Salt Lake, so I was able to get like a little bit of feedback here and there, but we didn't get to sit down like normal. But yeah, like normally we would just all sit down and like I'd have them like shoot me ideas and we'd all bounce ideas off each other, which is pretty cool.
Snowboards right now, let's say there's one thing in snowboarding, like fashion or riding style, that you could snap your fingers and it's done tomorrow, like it never existed,
tall tees. Those can go away. I don't mind like baggy clothes, but when I see like four tall tees poking out of the bottom of a jacket and it's all frozen because they've fallen a bunch, that just bugs me.
So over layering
is just silly. Looks like a rollerblader.
And then from like a riding style, is there anything that anything trending right now that bothers you about how people are snowboarding?
I would say like when people try to do too much with what they have, whether it's jumping and trying to spin the most they possibly can instead of doing something that just looks cool, like a frontside three with like a good grab and a tweak or whatever, or like spinning like crazy onto a handrail when like sometimes like a backflip that's done really well is more impressive to me than like a 360 onto a rail where they just barely make it off the end.
I think that happened just recently in the Big Aaron Style contest. The kid that won it did some crazy spin trick and beat out another Utah kid, Sage Kostenberg, who had a really clean 12, landed it, but it wasn't the, you know, that crazy next step, even though it looked super hucked.
He didn't flip. He just did a 1260, but didn't double flip in there.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a sad state that snowboarding has gone that route where it's like stuff. I feel like when I was younger, we made fun of that kind of stuff where you just hucked yourself.
It's like ice skating where yeah, it's trying to get the most rotations. And
it's like men's aerials in the Olympics where they just go off those crazy poppy jumps and just flip and spin like crazy. You don't even know what happened. And then they ride away.
That's what we need to add into snowboarding is if you're going to be a crazy flipper spinner, you have to land into moguls.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
And I would watch
flat.
That sport.
They land pretty flat too. Like 8, or probably more than that, like 16 feet up in the air.
Let's go to a top 5 tips for people who want to have a dialed kit. Not saying they have to dress one way or the other, but like what are 5 things that you can do to make sure you look not kooky on the hill?
Oh, man.
You look put together.
I don't know. I guess that's all relative to the person. But for me, I'm guilty of this in the past. Wearing slim pants is one thing, but don't wear jeggings on the mountain. That's
nobody wants to see a man's thigh.
No. No, you don't need to see that. No one needs to see that. So, slim pants, awesome. Jeggings, not so awesome. And then, you know, like, it's just like...
Are you an over glove?
Definitely under. Or no gloves, if it's not...
No gloves.
I'm a big fan of no gloves. I feel like my hands stay warmer because they don't get wet. Like, the water doesn't, like... I don't know.
I think that's called frostbite.
They get dry, but they don't get cold, really.
Okay,
but
so.
I'd just say, like, stay away from, like, crazy... You don't want too much going on, you know? You don't want, like, some crazy print on top and then another crazy print on the bottom or just two, like, contradicting bright colors with your helmet. It's just, don't look nuts out there, like...
How many danglers is too many danglers?
One dangler is too many danglers. Put your passer on your neck where it belongs.
I mean, you know obviously now how to get your kit dialed. You must have learned that through trial and error. What are some of the biggest regrets you have fashionably? I mean, you've been getting your photo taken as a professional snowboarder for many years. Like, when you look back on those old photos, what can you...
Oh, God.
What was I thinking?
It's well documented, the mistakes I've made. I would say I've gone through so many, like, genres of style in my days snowboarding, but I think, like... At the time, they weren't mistakes, but looking back, pretty embarrassing. Like, I had a nose ring for a little bit.
Oh, I forgot about
little,
that.
That's a good stud.
That's a good accessory. You don't see those these days.
Not on guys, anyway. That's a huge thing. I still have the hole in my nose. Man, it's never going to go away. It's been like 12 years, too. That's a mistake. I think I went through a phase where it was like, well, I mean, everybody did it this time. It was pretty baggy, pretty gangster, I guess, but not gangster. I was guilty of the puffy vest over a polo with a long sleeve shirt underneath the polo.
I'm going to have to go back and find these photos because you mentioned these things and I vaguely remember them, but that...
Just watch Love Hate. Pretty...
Oh, okay.
Pretty embarrassing kits in that.
As an influential movie, though, I feel like you wouldn't want that to go away. I mean, that's a part
of it. No. And honestly, I'm not, like... I'm not embarrassed of anything I've done. Everybody's guilty of... Right, you just do what's popular at the time. the tight pants, the real tight man jeggings, are probably, honestly, probably the thing I'm most embarrassed about, because I ran that for a while, especially snowboarding.
And that was back when it definitely was more on the baggy side of things.
So. Yeah.
For more information on John Cooley and more on L1, visit them online at l1outerwear.com. This is your weekly daily calendar from Slug Mag, and as always, you'll want to go to slugmag.com and check the listings. They are updated so often, you'll find something new every time you check back. This is for the week starting January 15th and running through the January 21st. Let's hit it up on Wednesday, January 16th, because I'm just flushing the 15th right down the toilet right now. There's nothing happening. Just stay home, everybody. On Wednesday the 16th, a great local rock show, Pleasure Thieves, God's Revolver, and Minerva are playing at Urban Lounge. And then, up at Kingsbury Hall, sort of an unusual event, Robin Williams, legendary comedian, formerly a good actor, eventually evolved into being a pretty shitty actor in a lot of shitty movies, went into rehab, got divorced, got remarried, you know, he's an evolving entity in the entertainment world. He's doing a show at Kingsbury Hall. It's not a stand-up gig, it's actually a sit-down gig. David Steinberg, who's sort of a famous director to people who are sort of comedy geeks, he's going to sit down and interview Robin Williams, so it should be kind of an interesting night. You'll get a lot of insight into Robin Williams' career from his stand-up days pre-Mork and Mindy all the way through his Oscar award-winning roles and his probably really bad movies with Billy Crystal that came later on. That should be interesting. On Thursday, January 27th, it's Speak for Yourself Poetry Night at Muse Music in Provo, so get up there and do a little poetry jamming of your own. Back in Salt Lake City at the Urban Lounge, you have Geographer, a fine San Francisco indie rock band. A lot of guitar and synthesizer, a little bit of cello, you get the gist of their sound. That's going to be one of the highlights of the week. That is also the opening night of Sundance, although just a few films going on up in Park City. On Friday, January 18th, it's Sirius Film Festival time. Both Sundance and Slamdance will be on in full force, so keep an eye out for special pop-up events that you can get into as a member of the general public. And if you have tickets to a movie, good on you, you're loving it. Also Friday, January 18th, a little hip-hop show at the Shred Shed featuring Dusk One and Mind State and Atheist. And down at Velour in Provo, it's part of their 7th anniversary shows, Desert Noises with the New Electric Sound. On Saturday, January 19th, it is the Slug Games at Brighton Resort. Revenge of the Nerds is the theme, a fine choice, I think. That is presented by Scion, Uinta Brewing, and Bush. A little punk show at Bert's Tiki Lounge featuring All Systems Fail. And at the Urban Lounge, you have Seawolf, who is also performing up at the Music Cafe during Sundance. He's playing along with the Devil Whale and Pentagram Crackers at the Urban Lounge. Back down in Provo at the 7th anniversary shows at Velour, it's The Moth and the Flame and Parlor Hawk on Saturday, January 19th. On Sunday, January 20th, Cory Mann, a fine singer-songwriter in his own right, he's headlining a show at The Garage. And then on Monday, January 21st, the political hip-hop of Dead Prez, one of my personal favorites, they're headlining a show at the Urban Lounge. As always, check slugmag.com, check the listings. If you want to submit your own, that's free for you to do. Just hit it up online, or for $5 a month or a mere $50 a year, you can add a lot of quality content to make your listings pop. That's your weekly daily calendar. Hang Time is the latest project from the man of a million bands, Will Sartain, along with Kathy Foy, Andrew Sato, and TJ Fitzgerald. The group started in the spring of 2012, and a mere 6 months later or so, they released their self-titled full-length album on, of course, Kilby Records. The band will have two official album release shows, one at Urban Lounge on January 25th and one at Kilby Court on February 9th. Here is a song called Awesome Rad off of Hang Time's self-titled debut.
Yeah.
For more information on Hangtime, visit them online at facebook.com/hangtime. The Hangtime comes two times. This is going to be the first time we have delved into the world of NBA basketball here on the podcast, at least since I've been around these parts, and we have brought in Slug Magazine, resident expert, we will call him, fan, I'm assuming.
Can you address me as an NBA analyst?
NBA analyst and analyst. Insider, Mike Brown.
Yes.
First of all, tell us a little bit about your personal history with the Jazz, as either a fan or a hater or whatever made you sort of
right.
Observer and analyst.
Anally speaking, I was trampled by a horse when I was a kid, when I was nine. Let me back up a little bit, but that will come into play.
Excellent. And so we're going back beyond 9 years old.
Okay. Well, no, okay, this all kind of happened when I was 9 years old. My dad had season tickets to the Jazz in the Salt Palace. So keep in mind, this is like 88, 89, you know, he's starting to take me to games. I don't know if you ever went in that old building in the Salt Palace. It looked like a
the old school round
drum.
Thing with
yeah.
curtains on the sides and
yeah.
stuff. Yeah.
It was not very big, but they had like a real jazz band.
Yep.
But they also had like fucking bleachers that you could walk under. I mean,
yeah,
it
yeah.
was like
a high school gym style.
It was
places.
Like a high school gym.
Yeah.
You know, kind of the state of the NBA back then. Really, it was kind of, I would say, a good comparison and maybe be like pro soccer in America now.
Yeah, burgeoning. Growing.
Where, you know, in 20 years, it's probably going to be like all, and then yeah. Michael Jordan comes in and fucks up all the rules and makes it popular and
right.
Nike and Gatorade somehow.
Prices out the common man's ability to go to the games and whatnot.
Exactly. You know. And a lot of that was David Stern, too. Cleaning it up. But anyway, my dad had season tickets and would take me to games. And that's when I started becoming like a fan. And the two players I liked the most when I was a little kid, I liked Karl Malone because I could hear him swear from the court. And you know, when you're like a little kid and you hear a grown up swear and it's kind of a big
ooh,
deal, you're
yeah.
like, oh, you know.
Especially in a Louisiana drawl swearing. Yeah.
I just remember being like, fucking bullshit.
Yeah.
Like, rad. And of course, Mike Brown. His backup power forward.
Hell yeah.
Favorite player for obvious reasons. So,
love Mike Brown.
So back to me getting trampled by a horse. My sister's horse trampled me. Little side note, I couldn't eat anything
because
it like fucked up my pancreas.
Yeah.
And so whenever I did take pain medicines, I did have to take them anally as a 9-year-old. Yeah.
Hence the analyst of the
Hence
Jazz.
The analyst, yeah. I don't know how much that has to do with basketball or, you know, going for two, whatever. It did feel just, if you've never had a gigantic Advil suppository shoved up you, it feels like taking a dump backwards if you've never had that happen.
That's
but
rough.
It's rough. But anyway, so I'm in the hospital. I have this big fucking IV thing connected. And this is the old Primary Children's. Like, the new one's not done, so we're in the avenues. And Karl Malone and Mike Brown come down to visit the kids. And
whoa.
I happen to be, they're actually there to see the more terminally ill kids, you know. But since that hospital was a lot smaller, everyone's kind
of. You got lumped in with those guys.
But, yeah. And I actually had my Mike Brown poster and my Karl Malone poster in my fucking hospital room.
Whoa.
Like, this wasn't.
Serious fandom.
Yeah, I was
yeah.
a fan. And,
yeah.
You know, because
you travel
I was
with
in
your
the,
shit.
I was in the hospital for over a month, so it's like, you know. Had my fucking stuffed animals.
Ooh,
just,
yeah,
know,
that's serious.
You get to kind of deck it out how you want. But so anyway, my dad comes busting in the room, and he's like, "Mike, you won't believe who's here: Karl Malone and Mike Brown." And like, I start shaking, you know, because I'm just like, "Oh," you know, and I grab my posters and like, you know, walk out, and I have this fucking big IV attached to me, and I'm like holding these posters in a fucking hospital gown, like,
"Mike
you know?
Brown."
Yeah, and. And Karl kind of snubs me, kind of walks by. I don't think he noticed me or nothing. And fucking, I walk up to Mike Brown, and I can't even talk, you know. And I'm holding the poster and a pin. And he's like, "What's up, man?" And it's just super nice. And he's like, "What's your name?" And I'm like, "I'm Mike Brown." And, you know, he's like, "Oh, that's really cool," you know, signs a poster. And my dad's kind of talking to them. And then he grabs Karl, and he's like, "Hey, Karl, come sign Mike Brown's poster." And then, you know, like, beautiful childhood moment. And then later on in life, it's the moment got kind of ruined. I learned this from my dad.
Uh-oh.
You know, he's ruined a lot of my childhood. But, you know, I'm just kidding. I love you, Dad. That's never going to listen to this podcast. He said that what happened, you know, because kind of going back to the NBA, like, before the Jordan era really took off and made it fucking
huge business.
Yeah. He walked up to Mike Brown and was like, yeah, you know, I sit three rows behind you guys. I'm a season ticket holder and blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, the team had to do...
And my baby, Mike Brown, is in the hospital.
Yeah.
Come on.
But, you know, the players had to do a lot of PR stuff that they're not going to fucking do today.
They park your car back then.
They would. Yeah.
If you're a season ticket holder.
But they also, most season ticket holders were probably making more money than them.
Yeah, right.
And so, anyway... He's like, you know, thanks. I really appreciate that. That's really cool, you know. And so what he actually said to Carl Malone was, hey, Carl, come sign Mike Brown's poster. His dad's a season ticket holder.
Please.
Yeah, please. But I.
But yeah.
But yeah.
We do what the season ticket holders say.
We do, yeah. Pretty much.
Yeah.
And to this day, you know, it's still kind of like that. Because I did get to meet John Stockton, Jerry Sloan, and Karl Malone this year, which was fucking crazy.
A lifelong romance was born out of this near tragedy of you getting trampled by a horse.
Right. And it's funny because I told Carl that. I was like, you know, I genuinely thanked him.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm sure you don't remember.
Right, right. This
is like over 20 years ago.
Sure.
But
awesome.
When you visited me as a kid in the hospital, and it made me a fan.
Yeah.
And another thing, coincidentally enough, first jazz game I went to was Jerry Sloan's first game coaching.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that is serious. You put in some serious time.
I've got some emotional ties to
Absolutely.
It, to say the least, where like, yes, I'll always be a jazz fan. Unless they move the fucking franchise, which if they do, then...
That won't happen.
Okay, they better not.
But you're a lifer, and I think that puts you into, while you're an extraordinary individual in everyday life, you can represent the common Utahn who's also a jazz fan, certainly, for our analyst needs.
Right.
You are the perfect man to go to.
It has to be looked at anally.
That's right. So, they've had a long storied history, obviously. You've grown up with them, you've seen them through the years. Here we are in 2013, Jerry Sloan's gone. After a rather convoluted exit, the team turned over from the Carl and John days to a brief interlude of Darren Williams and Carlos Boozer and getting to the conference finals there briefly there. Now they're in this sort of, you know, rebuilding mode, right? So as a guy who's been a fan for long and through the salad days when they were going to the finals with these Hall of Fame players and coaches, is it more difficult for you to kind of, you know, feel connected to a new team where you have a bunch of new players coming in this year, you know, stuff like that?
I think the weirdest part about it is just as jazz fans, even though we haven't won a championship because of a conspiracy I have that is in regards to NBC, Nike, Gatorade, and Michael Jordan.
Bastards, all of them.
All of them. As a franchise, we've been pretty spoiled.
I concur.
Larry Miller went above and beyond what ownerships need to do in sports as far as making money. I have a list of some of my favorite entrepreneurs, not necessarily my favorite people,
right?
But my favorite entrepreneurs. It goes, what is it? Joseph Smith.
Nice.
Not my favorite person by any means,
but
anybody that can get people to pay 10% of everything they own for the rest of their life, you're brilliant.
Yeah.
Henry Ford and Larry Miller, that is definitely on that list. But it's also one of those things where, you know, it's kind of a very melancholy time to be a fan compared to those salad days where, you know, and then even the transition moving to, like, you know, Darren Williams and Carlos Boozer and Sloan still being around because when Stockton and Carl left, everybody thought Sloan was gone.
Right.
And everybody thought that as soon as they won a title that all of those guys would retire. And there were those 2 years where we just kind of assumed we were going to win a title.
Right.
It was just...
So close.
It was so close. But everybody... I remember, like, those seasons, and everybody's like, oh, yeah, we got this.
Yeah, right.
It's going to happen. Especially the year after we lost the first time.
Yeah.
And
we had home court advantage.
We had home court advantage. We had, you know... Little did we know, Michael Jordan was going to... You know, have his famous flu game where he was hungover, by the way.
Hungover from an all-night gambling session
in
Vegas. An all-night
gambling session, fucking.
And then pushed off Brian Russell.
He took the fun bus. But anyway, no, just real quick, I think my conspiracy there is back then in that media landscape, how much money do you think those companies, Gatorade, Nike, the NBA, and NBC, how much money would they have lost if the Jazz have won? It would have been astronomical.
Yeah. They would have been forced to put the jazz on TV a lot.
And I know people say, I appreciate a good conspiracy, but I wouldn't necessarily say I'm like a conspiracy theorist with a lot of things. Like,
You don't spin your own necessarily.
I don't spin my own. Not automatically. And, you know, granted, Michael Jordan is the best fucking player of all time. You can't really take that away from him. But, you know, looking back at some of the stuff, people always talk about the push-off. Not a lot of people, but diehard jazz fans remember this. The Phantom 3 by Howard Eisley that got waved off by Dick Vivetta. Fuck that guy. I'm still mad at Dick Vivetta.
And he's still kicking around, right?
He's still reffing.
You go out and haze him when he comes to town.
He looks like the fucking, what's the dude's name from Tales from the Crypt?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He looks just
the
like
Crypt Keeper.
The Crypt Keeper. Right. I don't know if he has a name. Yeah, I don't know. There was a lot more going on that just... It just strikes me as weird. Like, I almost, there's part of me that if I was a true conspiracy theorist, I think Carl was in on it.
Like, got a little piece of the action, maybe?
Got for, you know, his shitty
missing
defense.
Missing his free throws.
Yeah,
and,
letting Jordan steal ball. That ball, you know?
So have you looked into, you know, other teams that were vanquished by the Bulls, like, you know, the Sonics one year, the Suns one year? There
well,
might be other conspiracies you can tie in. All these small market Western teams.
For every conspiracy in at least that one, there's like three or four that offset it, you know? Like Indiana.
Right.
Reggie Miller never getting a title. New York. It's not like we're the only team that Bulls dynasty absolutely fucked in the ass.
And turned the NBA into mega biz.
And just
right?
exactly yeah. made it a mega business. I mean, Jordan, you got to understand, and I think a lot of people don't understand this, and there's a book I've been meaning to read called The Jordan Rules that kind of explains this more, but he basically, back when Stockton and Malone were first playing, and when in the mid-80s, you know, the NBA was fucking thug. It was thug. Like there was a little... Did you see the little altercation between Derek Favors and...
Right, a little shoving here and there.
Little shoving
like
here and there. Okay, back then, that wouldn't have even been a flagrant.
Yeah.
That wouldn't have even been...
I was a Pistons fan, the Bad Boys. They laid people out right and left
man.
Back then. Before I was a Jazz fan.
Right?
I'll couch that in. I'm a
Bill
Jazz
Lambeer.
Fan now. Yeah.
Oh,
Dennis
man.
Rodman, before he was just a freak show, he was just muscle.
Even Isaiah was fucking dirty, but it was... That's how the league was. It was like, you're not a pussy, and it revolved around your big guys. It was about the big guys in the middle, and if you were a point guard or a shooting guard and you came in the lane, you were getting fouled the fuck out of there. Yeah, and that's just how the game was played. And so Jordan changed that. Jordan's marketability, how he was able to, his talent, you know, all of it combined just made it so, you know, now all of a sudden when you go in a lane and you shove this guy, you know, David Stern's thinking, we gotta protect this cash cow.
Right, we're finding that guy.
We're finding that guy. And that's just how it is. And, you know, you could argue if it's made the game better or worse. It's probably more of an opinion, but...
Well, here's what I'll throw at you, though. I think that the Jordan era that you're talking about turned it into this superstar league where they do protect guys like him. And I have Jazz friends who look at the Jazz team now, and it's like, we have a bunch of great players, but there's no superstar guy that the league is going to look out for on the Jazz, right?
Yeah.
Arguably, D. Will was that guy before they traded him, but now it's like, do we have that guy? Right, yeah.
No, we don't.
We don't.
And that's where small franchises are at these days. That's what's kind of weird about it. The NBA, one thing David Stern has done but that I fucking hate, I kind of fucking hate David Stern. But
he's on his way out.
He's on his way out. He has turned the NBA into the most competitively unbalanced professional sports league in the world. Given the fact that the last, I think it's 30 years, only 8 different teams have won a title. 30 years? Or is it? I know it's at least 20.
Yeah, oh yeah.
It's something
like
that.
It's the Lakers,
like
the Bulls, the Spurs, the Celtics.
Celtics. It's
the Heat.
Every once in a while.
Yeah.
But
right.
it's but he allows that to happen ultimately. You know, with how the salary caps are set up and everything, I think it sucks because basically what happens to franchises like Utah, Indiana, and even you can say this will happen to San Antonio someday, but it's like they're farm teams. It's like they're farm teams
right.
for superstars now. And then the superstars, and a lot of this also has to do with the Olympics, which is another thing Stern's pushed hard. But the way the Olympic program is set up is fucked, because another big difference between kind of those days in the 80s and even in the 90s was like, motherfucker, those players were not friends, dude.
Right,
like,
right.
Larry Bird and Magic Johnson did not like each other.
Right.
Charles Barkley and Karl Malone, they might be friends now.
Yeah, but back then,
they did not like each other. And now with the Olympics...
They definitely weren't working out together in between seasons like they do now.
Kevin Durant and LeBron James worked out together this summer. Yeah,
last summer, too, right?
Dude, like, yeah. I get it. They're both amazing and talented and all of that. But, you know, it's like kind of maybe... I guess I enjoy kind of that more raw, thuggish style of basketball a little more instead of
You don't want to think they're all friends behind the scenes.
Yeah, I think NBA players... Like these days, most of them just are kind of just a bunch of pussies. And, you know, it's kind of like the Olympic team when they all get to bond. That's how those superstar teams are getting formed, because the guys become friends.
Right.
And then, like,
we want to play together.
We'll play together. Right. Let's start our own super team. And that's what's happening. And so it's player driven, which, you know, to an extent, the league should be player driven in a lot of accounts. Because people, other than
They're the ones earning money for everybody, right?
Exactly. I aren't, like, going to a Jazz game to watch the coach.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
The refs. The whatever, right.
Or the refs.
So what's your, you know, your prescription, I guess, for being a Jazz fan who you can go into every season thinking, we're going to be pretty good, we make the playoffs, which is awesome, but we're not going to win a title. How do you keep the passion, man?
How do I sleep at night?
How do you keep it going?
First off, I tell myself I'm glad I'm not a Cubs fan.
Well, yeah, true.
And that's just how it is. And I think one big aspect of it, too, that I think people forget a lot is that it is just fucking entertainment.
Yeah.
For as much as I love the Jazz and as passionate as I am about it, I can't believe it when, like, people come up to me and are, like, you know, in a bar or something and are, like, yelling at me or mad at me because they lost. And I'm like, motherfucker, I had nothing to do with that, you know? And, like...
I'm an analyst, not a player.
Yeah, I'm an analyst. So... I think that's kind of as far as like how I view it. It's entertainment.
Yeah.
It's drama.
And they're a pretty fun team to watch, even with new pieces in there, right?
I mean,
competitive, relatively.
Not so much these days. You know, honestly, as of right now, as of this podcast, based off of what I've seen out of them, I see them exactly where they're going to be at last year. It's sneaking into the playoffs.
Maybe make the playoffs.
Maybe.
Right.
And a lot of that is because the West is good. It's better than it was last year.
Yep.
They're just not there yet. They're developing players. I think they do need to trade Paul Millsap. Al Jefferson's gone after this year. The team could look totally different next year. More than half the team has contracts up. I mean, it's fucking... So it's also kind of more like about enjoying the moment.
Yeah.
And it's always kind of been that way with basketball. That's the one good thing about basketball is that it's kind of like...
Well, we're never going to have Carl and John for 15 years ever again.
No.
It's not going to happen.
No.
You're rooting for a jersey more than the guys almost.
It's not going to happen. And the fact that we did have them, we were incredibly lucky.
Yeah.
Incredibly
People know Utah
lucky.
Because of that team and those guys and Jerry Sloan.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you go on the East Coast, people don't know what Utah is as outside of the Jazz. And I don't think a lot of people realize that. Like, you go other places in the country, it's fucking, you know,
that's
Utah,
know.
Utah City, where is that? You know?
It's right.
Like, I don't know. That's kind of where I try to keep my focus, but I still, you know, I still freak out when they play like shit.
Well, that's what being a fan is.
Exactly.
Well, we will check back in as this season progresses. Right now, we are heading into a new year or just into the new year. We're going to see trade deadline will probably pass in between the next time we talk to you. And it might be a different looking team the next time we sit down here.
It really could be. Yeah, it'll be interesting. And that's what's fun to watch.
Absolutely. Everybody, read Mike Brown's Dirt Sheet column every month in Slug. Mike, thanks for coming in and being a damn fine analyst.
Can I plug my Instagram and Twitter?
Plug it.
You can follow me on Instagram at Fagatron. Spelled as it sounds. Okay. And you can follow me on Twitter at Fuck Mike Brown.
There you go. Fuck Mike Brown. Mm. Thank you, sir. As always, thank you for listening to the Sound Waves from the Underground podcast. For all things Slug Magazine, visit slugmag.com. As we mentioned in this episode, we are in the heart of film festival season, and we want to hear your highlights from Sundance, Slam Dance, or any other affiliated festival. You can either send us an email to soundwaves@slugmag.com or call and leave us a message on our automated voicemail line at 858-233-9324. That line's open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And if you give us a good tip, we just might play you on a future show. This podcast was created by Slug Magazine and produced by Gavin Sheehan. Associate producers are Esther Moronio, Ricky Vigil, Alexander Ortega, and Dan Nalen. That's me. Executive producer is Angela Brown.
The theme was performed by Birthquake and recorded by Jesse Ellis. The main logo and art design is by T. Doan, and technical design is by Kate Colgan. In our next episode, you will get local singer-songwriter David Williams, always an interesting guy to chat with. Slug beer columnist Mike Riedel will be back in the studio, and Dance for the Camera will be featured, so be sure to tune in. Thank you very much.